We left off last time right in the middle of chapter 45 of Genesis, and it was a very good place to leave off. In fact, it would have been, in my opinion, a better place for the chapter to break than where the chapters are divided, actually, because it brings us to the point where Joseph has revealed his identity to his brothers and made it clear that he does not plan any reprisals against them. He does not plan to punish them for what they did to him. He sees it as something that God actually arranged for their own salvation and his and of the whole family, because had Joseph never been in Egypt, it is figured that they would never have had the opportunity to survive this famine. You know, it's another thing, another angle on even the fact that the butler forgot about Joseph. Remember when Joseph interpreted his dreams and said, "Remember me when you restored to Pharaoh's house." The butler was restored, but he forgot Joseph for 2 years and didn't remember him until Pharaoh had his dreams. If the butler had remembered Joseph earlier, if in fact the butler had spoken up for Joseph prior to the Pharaoh having his dreams, it's possible that Joseph would have been released and would have gone home and would have never been around to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. I mean, it was better for Joseph to stay those 2 years in prison, because then he happened to be around when Pharaoh needed someone to interpret his dreams. Whereas if the butler had remembered him sooner, had gotten him delivered from prison and he'd head on home, he was a free man, that would have been the greatest thing he could imagine happening to him. But something even greater happened, more than we could ask or think, God had in mind, but it required him staying around for 2 years in prison so that he'd be there at the right time when Pharaoh had the dreams. Now his brothers have, been terrified by the awareness that Joseph is in power and they're at his mercy, but he has done all he can to allay their fears. He says, "Go down and tell my father that I'm alive." That would be a very embarrassing thing for them to have to tell their father, since that would certainly lead to Jacob asking many questions about what had happened to Joseph in the first place. And the brothers were going to have to eat some crow, obviously, in this situation, but it was still, in some cases, better for them that they have to face the music themselves of their father than for Joseph to be angry and torture them and kill them, as he could have done. Well, now, verse 16 is where we pick up where we left off. "Now the report of it was heard in Pharaoh's house, saying, 'Joseph's brothers have come.' So it pleased Pharaoh and his servants well. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, 'Say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and depart and go to the land of Canaan. Bring your father and your household and come to me. I will give you of the best of the land of Egypt, and you will eat and be fat eat of the fat of the land. Now you are commanded, do this, take carts out of the land of Egypt for your little ones and your wives, and bring your father and come. Also, do not be concerned about your goods, for the best of all the land of Egypt is yours.'" In other words, if you have houses or possessions in the land of Canaan and you're loath to leave them behind, don't worry about that. You'll have better things here than what you're leaving behind. Just come. After all, there are 5 more years of famine to go, and they'd just starve if they stayed there, or else they could keep making trips to Egypt. But why not just move there and have just live under the spout where the provision comes out and be there in Egypt or with Joseph? "And the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them carts according to the command of Pharaoh, and he gave them provisions for the journey. He gave to all of them, to each man, changes of garments," which was, by the way, an expensive commodity in ancient times. Giving someone a garment was to give them something that was very hard to come by and very expensive generally. "But to Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. And he sent to his father these things: 10 donkeys loaded with good things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread and food for his father for the journey. So he sent his brothers away, and they departed, and he said to them, 'See that you do not become troubled along the way.' When they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father, and they told him, saying, 'Joseph is still alive, and he is the governor over all the land of Egypt.' And Jacob's heart stood still because he did not believe them." Couldn't allow himself to believe it. It was too much of a letdown if it turned out to be a joke. But when they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. Then Israel said, "It is enough. Joseph, my son, is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." Chapter 46. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in visions of the night and said, "Jacob, Jacob." And he said, "Here I am." And he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again, and Joseph will put his hand on your eyes." Then Jacob arose from Beersheba, and the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones and their wives, in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry him. So they took their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now, the only thing here I'd like to point out is that God specifically appeared to Jacob and said, "Don't be afraid to go down to Egypt. I'm with you in this." Now, you remember that there had been a famine in Canaan before, and Abraham had gone down to Egypt and got into trouble, saying that Sarah was his sister and got embarrassed and so forth. And it wasn't right for Abraham to go down there. He went down to Egypt because of a famine in Canaan, and because apparently he wasn't so sure God could provide for him in Canaan, so he went to Egypt without any instructions from God. A generation later, Isaac also faced a famine in Canaan. But God specifically told him, "Don't go down to Egypt. I will bless you in this land." And so he didn't go to Egypt. He didn't make the same mistake Abraham had made. And God blessed him with plenty of crops in the land. Now, Jacob, even though there's been a famine in the land for 9 years already, Jacob has not gone to Egypt. Probably learning a lesson from Abraham and Isaac. He has not been instructed by God to go to Egypt. And God had specifically instructed Isaac under similar circumstances not to go to Egypt. But now God has to release Jacob to go, because Abraham was wrong to go. Isaac would have been wrong to go if he had gone. And Jacob wasn't so sure it would be right for him to go. Just because Joseph was inviting him didn't mean that God wanted him to make the trip, if the example of Abraham and Isaac were any example or any precedent. So God actually appeared to him and released him and said, "Go on, don't be afraid to go to Egypt. I'm releasing you to go there. I'm going to make you a great nation while you're down there." Now, there were 70 adult males that went down there, we'll read later on, in the family. And they did become a great nation in Egypt. In about 430 years' time, they became a multitude of about 600,000 adult males, not including women and children. So they became a very large nation while they were in Egypt. Of course, we know that they stayed in Egypt a little too long. After Joseph died, the family of Jacob were pretty comfortable down there. They stayed in Egypt. Rather than go back to the Promised Land, they ended up being enslaved by a later Pharaoh and put under hard bondage for a long time until Moses was raised up to deliver them. Verse 8, now these were the names of the children of Israel, Jacob and his sons, who went down to Egypt. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. The sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon were Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi were Gershon, Mohath, and Merari. Kohath, and Merari. These three became three clans of the Levites later on, from whom the tabernacle was cared for. And each of these groups, the Gershonites, the Kohathites, and the Merarites, the sons of Levi, had different tasks with reference to the transportation and operation of the tabernacle. The sons of Judah were Onan, Shelah. Now we know and Onan died. Died, Onan took his wife, and Onan died. And Shelah, we don't know if he ever took the woman or not, because by the time he could have, his father had already slept with her. In all likelihood, it would have been considered improper for him now to marry her, since the father had. But by his son's widows, Judah had also Perez and Zerah, the twins. It says, but Ur and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul, so there were some grandsons of Judah, apparently, that made this trip too. The sons of Issachar were Tola, Puva, Job, Shimron, and the sons of Zebulun were Sered, Elon, and Jalil. These were the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Paddan Aram, with his daughter Dinah. All the persons, his sons and his daughters, were 33. That is, of Leah's sons. Now we go on to the daughters of Zilpah, Leah's maid, verses 16 through 18. The sons of Gad were Zithion, Haggi, Shuni, Esbon, Eri, Arodi, and Areli. The sons of Asher were Jimna, Ishua, Isui, Beriah, and Sarah. That's a man's name there. Their sister. That was a female, but spelled differently than Sarah, their ancestors. And the sons of Beriah were Heber and Malchiel. These were the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah, to his daughter, and she bore Jacob 16 persons. Actually, she only bore two, but of them there were 16 derived by grandchildren. The sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, were Joseph and Benjamin. And to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, the priest of On, bore him. The sons of Benjamin were Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Huppim, and Ard. These were the sons of Rachel, who were born to Jacob, 14 persons in all. The son of Dan was Hushim. The sons of Naphtali were Zalil, Guni, Jazer, and Shillim. These were the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to Rachel, his daughter, and she bore these to Jacob, 7 persons in all. All the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who came from his body besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph, who were born to him in Egypt, were 2 persons, and all the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. That is, including Joseph and Jacob. There were 66 of the offspring that were delineated in verses 8 through 25, and then you add Jacob and Joseph to that, that makes 68, and then Joseph's 2 sons born in Egypt makes 70. Then he sent Judah before him to Joseph to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel, and he presented himself to him and fell on his neck and wept on his neck a good while. He hadn't seen his father, of course, for over 20 years. And they had had a very close relationship, and he had been the favorite son before, so it's quite a poignant reunion. And Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, because you're still alive." Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh and say to him, 'My brothers and those of my father's house who were in the land of Canaan have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. And they have brought their flocks and their herds and all that they have. So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, "What is your occupation?" that you shall say, "Your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth, even until now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen, for every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians." Now what he's saying is this: shepherding as a profession was held in contempt among Egyptians. That doesn't mean that there weren't any shepherds among them. They had sheep and herds. Even Pharaoh had herds, as we shall see. But it was considered to be a lowly profession, maybe like a janitor or something today. Maybe even worse. Maybe there's a stigma attached to it of uncleanness or something. It's hard to know. But the Egyptians found shepherds abominable. And Joseph said, when you meet the Pharaoh, advertise the fact that you're shepherds, because then he will allow you to stay in the land of Goshen, which is removed from the general population of Egypt, because the shepherds are not pleasing to Egyptians. This will give you an opportunity to be not integrated with the Egyptian population, but separated. And no doubt he had that in mind, in order that they might maintain their religious practices of Jehovah without offending the Egyptians, who were pagans. and that they would have more liberty to live their lives unsupervised and uncriticized by the pagans. He wanted to preserve their freedoms and probably the purity of their children from the Egyptian customs and religion and all that. So if they would advertise the fact that they are shepherds, the Pharaoh would be glad to put them aside far from wherever the other Egyptians are. And that would work out well for the maintaining the purity and the freedom of the people to worship God the way they want to. Now chapter 47. Then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers, their flocks and their herds, and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed they are in the land of Goshen." And he took 5 men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to sojourn in the land because your servants have no pasture for their flocks. For the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now, therefore, please, let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh, and Jacob blessed Pharaoh. It's an interesting act of blessing Pharaoh, because it was customary for the more exalted person to bless the less exalted, for the greater to bless the lesser. And here Jacob, who is an ordinary, herdsman, comes in and he blesses Pharaoh. And yet this is fulfillment of prophecy. All nations of the world would be blessed through Jacob's family. And so we see a beginning of it here. Pharaoh certainly was blessed. His life was preserved. His people's lives were preserved by what Jacob's son Joseph had been able to interpret. So we see the promises made to Abraham that in him all nations would be blessed, fulfilled in a very literal sense, though certainly not in their ultimate sense, by Joseph preserving many nations alive in this time of famine. All nations were blessed through him. And that's a precursor, of course, of all nations being blessed through Jesus, another son of Jacob, of whom Joseph may have been a type. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" That was not considered rude in that society. Actually, being old was an honorable thing. Nowadays, you don't ask old people their age. But so, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimages are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of the years of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers in the days of their pilgrimage." So at 130 years old, he thought he hadn't really been given a very long life, because both Abram and Isaac had lived longer than that. But the lifespans were trailing down at this point in history. So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Rameses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Then Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread, according to the number of their families. Now the rest of this chapter just shows how Joseph dealt with the Egyptians for the remaining 5 years of the famine. Each year the people had less that they could spend to buy food from him, and so he had them barter their possessions and their lands and even themselves year by year, until all the land actually became government land and all the people became government slaves, because they needed food and they had nothing else to offer but their land in one case or their bodies in the next. So that this shows how that the government came to be in possession, the Egyptian government came to be in possession of all the land. That is, private ownership ceased to exist as a result of this whole situation. Now, that doesn't mean that the lack of private ownership and government ownership is God's ideal. I frankly don't believe that that is true. In the land of Israel, when the Jews took the land, they each family had their own possession, which could never be taken from them permanently. They could sell it for a while, but in the next year of Jubilee, it would go back to the original owners. There was no government possession of land. God intended for his people to have private property. But in Egypt, for some reason, just by necessity, the people had nothing else they could offer but their lands and their bodies, so they ended up turning over everything they had to the Pharaoh in order to buy grain. And the remainder of this chapter 47, verses 13 through 26, is essentially the procedure. We read of how the remaining 5 years of famine progressed and how he sold grain to the people under these various conditions. Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So when the money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came to Joseph and said, "Give us bread, for why should we die in your presence? For the money has failed." Then Joseph said, "Give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone." So they brought the livestock to Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for the horses and flocks, the cattle of the herds, and for the donkeys. Thus he fed them with bread in exchange for all their livestock that year. When that year had ended, they came to him the next year and said to him, "We will not hide from my lord that our money is gone. My lord also has our herds and livestock. There's nothing left in the sight of my lord but our bodies and our lands. Why should we die before your eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be your servants, the servants of Pharaoh. Give us seed that we may live and not die, that the land may not be desolate." Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Only the land of the priests, this would be the Egyptian pagan priests, he did not buy, for the priests had rations allotted to them by Pharaoh, so they didn't have to bargain their land away. They weren't starving. They received a government stipend for their function as priests. And they ate their rations which the Pharaoh gave them, therefore they did not sell their lands. Then Joseph said to the people, "Indeed, I have bought you and your land this day for Pharaoh. Look, here is seed for you, and you shall sow in the land. It shall come to pass in the harvest that you shall give one-fifth to Pharaoh. Four-fifths shall be your own, as seed for the field and for your food, for those of your household and as of food for your little ones." So they said, "You have saved our lives. Let us find favor in the sight of my lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants." And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt to this day that Pharaoh should have one-fifth. That's the taxation of the produce of the land, sort of like income tax, except for the land of the priests only, which did not become Pharaoh's. What's interesting about this is that these people were considered slaves. This was a slave state. And how much tax do they pay? 20%. In this country, the richest people, if they don't have tax shelters, even middle-class people pay, what, 30, 40% income tax in this country? And we're considered free. This was what was charged of slaves. The slaves were allowed to keep 80% of all they could produce by their own labor and pay only 20%. That was a slave's tax level. Now, of course, this is very charitable of Joseph because very wise, because they still needed people to take care of the herds and they needed people to farm. Even though it was famine, they still could grow a tiny bit here and there and irrigate from the Nile and so forth. And whatever they produced, they could keep 80% up for themselves. Now, a slave, generally speaking, would be fed and housed and clothed by his master, but he generally wouldn't be able to keep 80% of the estate, and the master only get 20%. And so we see that it's very much like becoming a disciple of Jesus. We sell our bodies, we sell our lands, we sell all that we have into slavery. We're bought with a price, and we're owned by God. But he says, "Okay, now go out and be fruitful and multiply and basically produce something, occupy until I come." And a certain portion, actually a very generous portion, of what we make is legitimately used on providing our own and our family's needs. These are God's resources, and all the money, all the grain grown was Pharaoh's. 100% was Pharaoh's. But he only required them to turn over 20%, and they could use 80% for their own needs. Now, I'm not saying that that percentage applies to Christians today, but if it did, it'd be twice the tithe that you'd be expected to give up to the Lord. But of course, I believe all that we have is the Lord's, but a certain percentage, even in some cases, most of it, may be necessary and legitimately used on family needs. Most people cannot afford to live on less than half their income, so the majority of it is used for necessary things, but whatever is not used for necessary things is the Lord's. Verse 27, so Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the length of Jacob's life was 147 years. And when the time drew near that Israel must die, he called his son Joseph and said to him, now, if I have found favor in your sight, please put your hand under my thigh and deal kindly and truly with me. Please do not bury me in Egypt, but let me lie with my fathers. You shall carry me out of the land of Egypt and bury me in the burial place, in their burial place. And he said, I will do as you have said. Then he said, swear to me. And he swore to him. So Israel bowed himself on the head of his bed. Now, put your hand under my thigh is also what Abraham had told his servant to do in chapter 24 when he was exacting an oath from him to get a wife for Isaac. It would apparently be a typical way in the Middle East of that time to take an oath. I'm not sure exactly what was suggested by putting the hand under the thigh, but it was obviously a custom that very foreign to us, but meaningful to them. The next chapter goes on. Now it came to pass after these things that Joseph was told, indeed your father is sick. And he took to him his two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. These were Joseph's sons, born in Egypt. And Jacob was told, look, your son Joseph is coming to you. And Israel strengthened himself and sat up on the bed. Then Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz, which as you know is the older name for Bethel, in the land of Canaan, and blessed me, and said to me, behold, I will make you fruitful and multiply you, and I will make you a great multitude of people, and give this land to your descendants after you as an everlasting possession. And now, your two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. As Reuben and Simeon, they shall be mine. Now let me tell you what this means. Reuben and Simeon, of course, were the oldest two sons of Jacob. And he says, just like Reuben and Simeon, Ephraim and Manasseh are going to be mine. This means that he didn't adopt Reuben and Simeon's and Levi's and Judah's grandchildren to be full sons of his. But he adopted Joseph's two sons to be full sons of his. And the reason for that is that they would become tribes then, just like the other sons of Jacob be tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, which would really, if this transaction had not taken place, they would just be two parts of one tribe, just like the tribe of Levi had three parts, because Levi had three sons. Joseph's tribe would have been had two parts, but it would still be one tribe. And as such, when the land of Canaan would be divided among the tribes, Joseph would ordinarily get one portion, and each of the tribes would get one portion. But what he arranged is that Joseph's two sons would each become a tribe in their own right. So now there'd be 13 sons to divide it up with. And two portions would go to Joseph's sons, so that the tribe of Joseph gets a double portion. What this means is that Jacob is making arrangements here for Joseph to receive the birthright, the double portion aspect of the birthright. Now Judah received the spiritual birthright of spiritual leadership over the family. And Jesus, of course, came from Judah. But this chapter tells us how it is that Jacob arranged for his favorite son, Joseph, to receive the material aspects of the birthright, because Joseph would have ordinarily been just one of 12 sons and would have received his tribe would have received one portion in the land among the 12. But this way, his tribe gets two portions. And therefore, the tribe of Joseph gets a double portion, because Ephraim and Manasseh each get their own portion. This significance of this event is so stated in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verses 1 and 2. In 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2, it says, now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was indeed the firstborn. It interrupts the sentence. But because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel. So that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler, although the birthright was Joseph's. Now notice it makes a distinction between Judah and Joseph. The lineage was counted through Judah, not Joseph. But the birthright, and that is the ordinary material aspects of the birthright, were given to Joseph. And that was done in this way. The birthright, Jacob didn't really have a lot of stuff to leave. I guess he did have stuff to leave, but that wasn't the important inheritance he passed on to his sons. The land of Canaan was what his sons would inherit. And when it was divided up, each tribe got a portion. But Ephraim and Manasseh, being treated as full tribes, they each got a portion, whereas they would have each gotten half a portion if it had just been Joseph and not his sons being counted as a tribe. So we don't really read of the tribe of Joseph in the future. Very rarely. Only in peculiar situations do you read of the tribe of Joseph. But usually you read of the tribe of Ephraim and Manasseh in the list of tribes. And they are the tribe of Joseph, broken down into two tribes. Now, Jacob says in verse 6, "Your offspring whom you beget after them shall be yours." And we don't have record that Joseph did have any more. "And will be called by the name of their brothers in their inheritance. But as for me, when I came from Paddan, Rachel died beside me in the land of Canaan on the way. And when there was a little distance to go to Ephrath, and I buried her there on the way to Ephrath," that is Bethlehem. "Then Israel saw Joseph's sons and said, 'Who are these?'" This is just a formality. Jacob's eyes, I think, were poor at this point in his old age. "And Joseph said to his father, 'They are my sons whom God has given me in this place.' And he said, 'Bring them to me and I will bless them.' Now the eyes of Israel were dim with age so that he could not see." At least he couldn't see perfectly. "Then Joseph brought them near him and he kissed them and embraced them. And Israel said to Joseph, 'I had not thought to see your face, but in fact God has also shown me your offspring.' So Joseph brought them from beside his knees, and he bowed down with his face to the earth. And Joseph took them both, Ephraim with his right hand toward Israel's left hand, and Manasseh with his left hand toward Israel's right hand, and he brought them near him." Now, Manasseh was the older one. Therefore, he should receive the right hand of blessing, which is the favored position. And Manasseh, the younger, Ephraim, the younger one, should receive the left hand of blessing. So when Joseph brought the two sons to Jacob and postured them in such a way that when Jacob put out his hands, he put it so that the right hand of Jacob would go on the head of the older son, Manasseh, and the left hand would go on the younger son, Ephraim. But it says in verse 14, "Then Israel stretched out his right hand and laid it on Ephraim's head, who is the younger, and his left hand on Manasseh's head, guiding his hands knowingly, for Manasseh was the firstborn." Now, it's Israel, although he was blinded, he somehow was guided by the Spirit of God, that he didn't put his hands straight out as he ordinarily would. He crossed his hands, and his right hand was put on the younger son. Once again, another generation where the younger one gets the priority over the older. Seems like every single generation we've studied so far in the family of Abraham, the oldest does not receive the normal birthright. And that's the case here also. "For he blessed, and he blessed Joseph and said, 'God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has fed me all my life long this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads, let my name be named upon them, and the name of my fathers, Abraham and Isaac, and let them grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth.' Now when Joseph saw that his father had laid his right hand on the head of Ephraim, it displeased him. So he took hold of his father's hand and removed it from Ephraim's head to Manasseh's head. And Joseph said to his father, 'Not so, my father, for this one is the firstborn. Put your right hand on his head.' But his father refused and said, 'No, I know of my son. I know. He also shall become a people, and he also shall be great, but truly his younger brother shall be greater than he, and his descendants shall become a multitude of nations.' So he blessed them that day, saying, 'By you Israel will bless, saying, May God make you as Ephraim and Manasseh, Thus he set Ephraim before Manasseh. Instead of saying, may God bless you as Manasseh and Ephraim, he said, as Ephraim and Manasseh, placing Ephraim, the younger son, in a position of priority over his older brother. Then Israel said to Joseph, behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers. Moreover, I have given you one portion above your brothers, which I took from the hand of the Amorite with my sword and my bow. Apparently, he's referring to the portion of land that he had purchased outside Shechem. Why he said he'd gotten it with his sword and his bow is not clear. Possibly, Levi and Simeon were his sword and his bow, as it were. They were the weapons that slaughtered the Shechemites and secured his claim on that land, although actually he ended up having to leave out of fear that there would be reprisals and didn't stay in that land. But there was a piece of land there outside Shechem, and as I pointed out in an earlier chapter, in chapter 34, we found that that is the same piece of land where Jesus met the woman at the well. It was the land that Jacob gave to Joseph. The woman at the well was proud of that fact. And there was a well there. And it was given to Joseph here, in addition to whatever other lands they would later inherit in the days of Joshua. Now, the significance of this chapter was, as I said, to show that Jacob managed to adopt Ephraim and Manasseh as full sons rather than grandsons, so that they became tribal heads too. And thus he gave Joseph the birthright, that is, the double portion of the birthright that ordinarily would be given to in any family. But Joseph was his favorite, and he got this birthright. Also, that Ephraim, the younger, was placed in priority over Manasseh, the older. Actually, as history progressed, Manasseh became a very small tribe, relatively small, and most of them didn't even ever come into the land. Manasseh and Reuben and Gad were three tribes that stayed pretty much on the outside of the land because they liked the pasture land there. And when the Jews went in and conquered the land of Canaan, Manasseh was one of the three tribes that desired to stay on the other side of Jordan. And while half of the tribe of Manasseh stayed outside Jordan, about half came in, Manasseh was a very small tribe within Israel. Ephraim, on the other hand, was the largest tribe in the northern part of Israel. We're getting ahead of ourselves, but as you study the book of Kings, you'll find that after Solomon's time, the kingdom of Israel divided into two nations, hostile to each other. The southern kingdom was just Judah and Benjamin, and Judah was the largest tribe, and Benjamin was one of the smallest, and therefore that southern kingdom was simply called Judah, because Judah and Benjamin were the only tribes in it, and Judah was so overwhelmingly large and significant compared to Benjamin, they just called that nation Judah. The northern kingdom was made up of the other 10 tribes, and the most prominent of them was Ephraim. Ephraim was the largest of the tribes of the north, and sometimes, although that northern kingdom was sometimes called Israel, it was also occasionally called Ephraim. Just as Judah, being the largest tribe of the southern kingdom, gave his name to the whole kingdom at times, in a manner of speaking, so Ephraim, being the largest kingdom of the northern, the largest tribe of the northern kingdom, gave his name sometimes as the label or the title for the whole nation of the north. But Ephraim did become a very, very significant tribe, very large and powerful, and that was something that Jacob foresaw prophetically announced. Now, in chapter 49, just as Jacob in chapter 48 blessed his two new sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, he has to bless his other sons before he dies, and chapter 49 contains the blessings. The longest blessings are given to Judah and to Joseph, and most of the others are rather short, and in many cases quite vague. As a Bible teacher, my desire is to be able to tell you exactly what each one means, because I'm a teacher, I'm motivated to want to clarify everything. But I have to tell you that no Bible scholar can tell you for sure what the meaning of some of these are, because there are times when a single line, a short sentence, is all that he says, and it's in figurative language, and it's just not known how it was fulfilled. I'm preparing you for disappointment in the sense that there will be some things that are said in this chapter that you'll say, I wonder how that was fulfilled, I wonder what that means. And I'm going to just have to say, I don't know, no one knows. I mean, we just don't have enough information about the later histories of these. But I will say this, that the prophecies or the blessings uttered over these sons of Jacob actually were fulfilled not in the persons of the sons themselves, but in the tribes that came from them. So we have in the blessing that is uttered over Judah, actually a prophecy that was fulfilled in the tribe of Judah, not in the man. And likewise in each of the other cases, what is said about them really applies initially to the person himself and then secondarily to the tribe, the ultimate fulfillment being in the tribal destinies of these 12 tribes. Chapter 49, and Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." Now, the last days, unfortunately, in our speech, in our common time, we think of that as the end times or the end of the world. Last days in the scripture actually simply means days that are later. Later than these. Sometimes they're called latter days. But these, the fulfillment of these was not necessarily in what we call the last days. As a matter of fact, possibly the most far-ranging prediction here is of Judah producing the Messiah. Now, we know that the Messiah appeared in what the New Testament writers called the last days. We will find in chapter 49, verse 10, a prediction of the coming of the Messiah. And when Jesus did come, the New Testament writers spoke of that as the last days. For example, the writer of Hebrews, in Hebrews 1:1 and 1:2, the first two verses of the book of Hebrews, says, "God, who at various times in different ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by his Son." So the appearance of Jesus and his speaking to us was a mark of the last days. Peter and Paul and John, in their writings as well, all make reference to them living in the last times or the last hour or the ends of the ages and so forth. I am of the opinion that when the New Testament uses the term last days, it generally is referring to the last days of the Jewish nation, which came to its collapse when Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans in 70 A.D., and the nation never has been restored. It's true there is a political nation there today. It's true the United Nations has called Israel a nation. And since 1948, May 14th, 1948, the United Nations declared Israel to be a nation. Well, that's very well and good. But they have not in any sense been restored to their biblical significance as God's chosen people. Nor do they control all the land that they once controlled. Nor do they even fully control Jerusalem. They do control the city of Jerusalem to a certain extent, but not enough, for instance, to give them the freedom to rebuild the temple, which they would like very much to do. They actually have to share some of the facilities there, some of the land, with the Muslims who have mosques that cannot be violated and so forth. So the Jews do not have a restored situation even now. But the nation actually came to its end under the judgment of God in the year 70 A.D., and the time before that, the whole generation before that, from 30 A.D. when Jesus was crucified to 70 A.D. when Jerusalem was destroyed, the apostles seem to refer to that as the last days, the last generation, the final hour, and so forth. It seems like it was the last days of the Jewish order of which they spoke. He might have meant that here, too. He might have meant that this is the state that the tribes will be, and some of the things that will be applicable to them, at the end of Israel's history. Certainly, the coming of the Messiah, predicted in verse 10, belongs to that period of the last days of Jewish history, that is, of the nation's history. And maybe some of these others do to some extent also. Verse 2, "Gather together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power." That's what he should have been. But here's what he really is. Verse 4, "Unstable as water. You shall not excel, because you went up to your father's bed. Then you defiled it." Then he turns to the other and says, "He went up to my couch. Can you believe it? You know? Can you believe this kid? He goes and sleeps with my concubine." And it states in 1 Chronicles, as I pointed out a moment ago, 1 Chronicles 5:1, that he was deprived of the birthright because he slept with his father's concubine. And so this act, which he had done much earlier in his life, decades earlier, and for which there had been no punishment exacted against him, now it comes home to roost. He loses his birthright. He's the firstborn. He would have been the excellency of dignity, the excellency of power. But that excellency will not come. He will not excel. The excellency of dignity and excellency of power should go to the firstborn. But he will not have that excellency. He will not excel. He is unstable as water. A man who cannot control his sexual drives to the point where he would do something as criminal merely to satisfy his passions, that man is unstable. That man cannot be trusted in a position of authority. It's amazing how many people today think that our president, who has similar instabilities to that of Reuben, only far worse because he's expressed them far more times than Reuben did, that many people say, that doesn't matter. He's a good president anyway. I like his policies. He's good for the country, you know. And yet Jacob assumed that a man who's unstable in terms of sexual self-control is certainly in no position to be a leader. And therefore, he cannot excel. He cannot be the firstborn. He's by birth the firstborn, but by privilege he will not be the firstborn. And therefore, the next in line for that privilege of firstborn status would be Simeon, and after him Levi. But they are taken together. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man. That'd be probably Shechem, although they slew all the men of the city of Shechem. And in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Hamstrung an ox is just a figure of speech. Here's a very good example of Hebrew poetry. How that you do not take it literally. It's amazing how many people say, well, the Bible prophecies are to be taken literally. Well, if you'll check it out, almost all the prophecies in the Old Testament are written in poetry. They're written in Hebrew poetry. And here's a good example of how literally you're supposed to take Hebrew poetry. Like English poetry. Poets use figures of speech. They use images that are not literal. It's part of the poetic license of a poet. The Hebrew poets did the same thing. They didn't hamstring oxen, as far as we know. Or if they did, probably not just one. He's just talking about how they expressed cruelty on a certain occasion. He doesn't even specify in exact literal terms what cruelty he has in mind, but no one can have any doubt about it. It was when these two men went in and slaughtered the men of Shechem, every last man. And he says of them in verse 7, cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So he actually curses them rather than blesses them. This is supposed to be the patriarchal blessing, and these are the ones who, after Reuben is disqualified, would be the next in line for the blessing of the birthright. But no blessing for these. They both receive a curse. Now, when he says, I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel, this actually was fulfilled to Simeon one way and to Levi another way. Simeon became a very insignificant tribe, very small. In the book of Numbers, there were two censuses taken of the tribes of Israel. And in the second census, which was taken just before Joshua took them into the land of Canaan. No, I take that back. It was not just before that. Yes, it was. It was just before Joshua took them into the land of Canaan. They took the second census. Simeon was the smallest tribe in the second census. Very small and insignificant. Later on, when Moses pronounced the final blessing on each of the 12 tribes in Deuteronomy chapter 33, he didn't even mention Simeon. Simeon was insignificant enough that wasn't even mentioned among the tribes in Deuteronomy 33, where Moses gives his final blessing on the 12 tribes. Furthermore, we read in Joshua chapter 19 that when Joshua was dividing up the land of Israel to the various tribes of Israel, the people of Simeon didn't even get a portion of their own. They just got to have a few cities within the territory of Judah. They didn't even get a portion of the land for themselves. They just got some cities
that were within the boundaries of Judah, according to Joshua 19, verses 1 through 9. So Simeon was kind of just scattered among the brethren, scattered in Judah, in various cities, rather than having their own discrete spot to call their own. Now, as far as Levi is concerned, we know quite a bit about Levi's later history because Moses and Aaron were of the tribe of Levi. And therefore, the priests who came from Aaron were of the tribe of Levi. And the whole tribe, on one occasion, stood by Moses and by God when the nation was worshiping the golden calf. And because of their loyalty at that moment, God later blessed them and made them the people who would inherit God himself. When Joshua was dividing up the land, God said, don't give the tribe of Levi a portion of the land because I am their inheritance. The Lord is their inheritance. And what Levi got was, again, cities. 48 cities, I believe it was. I might have the number wrong, but I believe it was 48 cities they received in all the tribes. The Levites were sort of like the ministers of Israel, and they were scattered and lived in Levitical cities within the territory of all the other tribes' boundaries. So both Levi and Simeon were, in fact, scattered throughout the nation of Israel rather than having their own portions of land. This is part of the curse that was on them, although in Levi's case, the grace of God is seen that since there was a turning of the hearts of the Levites, God did scatter them, but he scattered them in a positive sense, making them his priests and his ministers. Now we come to Judah. Judah is given much more attention because he is the most significant. And he is the next in line after Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. The next is Judah. And he didn't do anything to disqualify himself from the birthright. Sure, he, with the rest of the brothers, was involved in the selling of Joseph. But he actually spared Joseph's life when the others wanted to kill him. And he, of course, showed tremendous character when Benjamin was in danger. And Judah received the blessing of the birthright. He says, Judah, you are he whom your brothers shall praise. In other words, you'll have priority over your brothers. They'll praise you. They'll look up to you. And it's a play on words because the name Judah means praise. When he was born, his mother said, I will praise the Lord now. Named him Praise, Judah. And so a play on words. Judah, you are the one who your brothers will praise. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's children shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He bows down, he lies down as a lion, and as a lion, who shall rouse him? It's hard to know exactly what that means, except to say that just as the lion is an animal that has very few, if any, natural enemies, he's the king of the wild kingdom. So Judah would be the king among his brothers, and none would be able to supplant him or replace him or rouse him against his will. He'd be pretty much self-governing, like a lion would be. Now, the expression lion of the tribe of Judah is found in one place in Scripture, in Revelation chapter 5, where Jesus is referred to as the lion of the tribe of Judah, Revelation 5:5. The expression is not found in the Old Testament, but it probably harks back to this statement, that Judah is like a lion's whelp, and Jesus was the ultimate lion, the ultimate king that came from that tribe. Now it says in verse 10, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall the obedience of the people be. Now, scepter was a royal rod, a symbol of authority, a symbol of kingship. In lands that have kings, there usually is a scepter. The king doesn't keep it in his bedroom with him or in his closet. It's usually kept under lock and key because possession of the scepter is the emblem of actually being king. There have been cases where attempts have been made. There might even have been some successes where scepters have been stolen. And to steal a scepter would give you automatically the right of being king. Whoever has the scepter is the king. And so, you know, a scepter in lands where they still exist are probably kept in safes with huge, you know, guards in front of them to keep people from stealing them because the king's authority as king is emblemized by his possession of the scepter. To lose it is to lose his position. Now, it says the scepter will not depart from Judah. That means it will not be passed off from Judah to someone else. It will be in the hand of Judah. nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him, that is to Shiloh, shall be the obedience of the people. Now, Shiloh is a word different people have had different ideas of what it means, but Hebrew scholars often will say Shiloh means him to whom it belongs, or him whose it is. And that seems to be correct, because we have a similar statement in Ezekiel that seems to be parallel to this. In fact, Ezekiel is probably deliberately echoing this prophecy. And in Ezekiel 21, Ezekiel chapter 21, verses 26 and 27. This is a prophecy of the overthrowing of the king of Judah when he was going to go into Babylon. And it says in verse 25, "Now to you, O profane, wicked prince of Israel, whose day has come, whose iniquity shall end, thus says the Lord God, remove the turban, take off the crown." A crown, like a scepter, is the emblem of kingly authority. "Nothing shall remain the same. Exalt the lowly, abase the exalted. Overthrown, overthrown I will make it. Overthrown, it shall be no longer until he comes whose right it is, and I will give it to him." That is, the crown of the king of Judah would be taken from his head because he's going off into Babylon, and the kingdom of Judah and the kingship and the crown would be overthrown and continually overthrown. It would not be restored until the one comes who really deserves it. And then God says, "I'll give it to him." Well, that one who came was Jesus. You see, that Jeconiah was the last king of Judah who went into Babylon. After the Jews returned from Babylon, they never had a king from the tribe of Judah, never had a king of their own at all. They were always vassals under the Persians or under the Greeks or under the Romans. And in fact, even though they were vassals, after the kingdom was restored, there was no king in Judah for several hundred years after the Babylonian captivity. The crown of Judah was overthrown, 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 until he came whose it was. Now, what's interesting is that Jacob had said the same thing, using the image not of a crown but of a scepter. The scepter won't depart from Judah until Shiloh comes. That is, his whose right it is. Who's he who owns the scepter? He who rightly deserves the scepter. And it says, "To him shall be the obedience of the people." That, too, is a reference to Christ, the one who to whom the crown belongs. And really, even though there was no king in Judah after the return of the exiles from Babylon, the kings that ruled over them still gave them some authority, including the authority to punish criminals, even the power of capital punishment. But about 37 years before Jesus came, King Herod became king in Israel. Herod was not Jewish. He was part Israelite, but he was part Edomite. And the Roman government took away from the Jews the right to exercise capital punishment against criminals. That was left to the Romans to decide. And therefore, it was a taking away of the Jews' sovereignty over their own affairs and over their own law and so forth. And when that happened in 37 BC, it is said that some of the rabbis recognized this as a great calamity. And they said, "Woe unto us, for the scepter has departed from Judah, and Shiloh has not yet come." When the Jews actually lost the sovereignty of capital punishment to the Romans, they saw this as a loss of the scepter. It had departed from Judah, but Shiloh had not yet come. But the prophecy was, "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet until Shiloh comes." Well, the same generation that saw the scepter depart saw Shiloh come. Jesus was born while Herod the Great was still alive. It was in the person of Herod that the rabbis saw the departure of the scepter from Judah. But it was in the lifetime of Herod that Jesus was born. And therefore, there's a prediction here, not only that the Messiah would come and have the scepter, but even something about when his coming would be imminent. When the scepter would depart from Judah, that's when Shiloh would come. And so the rabbis knew, although they didn't acknowledge Jesus, they knew that this was the time and that Shiloh was overdue. And in fact, the Messiah did come at that general time, in the same generation that happened. Verse 11, "Binding his donkey to the vine, and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washed his garments in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are darker than wine, and his teeth whiter than milk. Now, this is a good example of symbolism, not to be taken literally. What is it saying? Well, if he binds his donkey to a vine, you normally would tie your donkey, which is a rather strong animal, to something that's immovable, like a tree, a hitching post, something strong that the donkey can't just walk off with it. But here he says, Judah will bind his donkey to a vine. Now, we can come up with all kinds of symbolism for that, you know, Jesus is the true vine or whatever, but that's not apparently intended here. What is intended here is that Judah's inheritance in the land of Canaan will be so fruitful, so lush, produce such healthy crops, that the vines themselves, the grapevines, which are usually spindly little things, will be strong enough to bind your donkey to, instead of to a tree. It's talking about the strength and the healthiness and the fruitfulness of the vines in Judah. As a matter of fact, Hebron, one of the cities in Judah, was the place from which the best grapes were grown in Israel. The best wine and grapes did come from the vineyards of Hebron. And the land south of there had the best pasture land. When it talks about him washing his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes, that's just Hebrew parallelism in the poetry. Washing garments in wine probably was not literal. But what he's saying is wine will be so abundant, the grapevines will be so lush, so fruitful, there'll be so much produce there that they could use wine for things you'd ordinarily use water for, like washing your clothes. Wine, of course, is considerably more expensive than water. But the idea is they'll have such a glut, such an abundance, that they can use wine instead of water for washing their garments if they wish. And as far as his eyes being darker than wine, I'm not sure how that's understood, but his teeth whiter than milk probably just talks about the fact that there'd be plenty of wine, there'd be plenty of milk. The land of Israel was called a land flowing with milk and honey, because of the pasture land that would allow a lot of cows, which produce milk, and the fruit that would encourage bees to produce honey and so forth. The idea here is a general image of fruitfulness of Judah. And it was truly the case that, at least in terms of wine, Judah was the most fruitful area in Israel later on. We have short blessings on Zebulun, Issachar, Dan, Gad, Asher, and Naphtali, and they are very vague in some cases. Sometimes it's not so hard to understand what's being said, but most of the time it is hard to know. Verse 13 says, Zebulun shall dwell by the haven of the sea. He shall become a haven for ships, and his border shall adjoin Sidon. Sounds like it's talking about just the territory that they will inherit and nothing else. Issachar is a strong donkey, lying down between two burdens. He saw that rest was good and that the land was pleasant. He bowed his shoulder to bear a burden and became a band of slaves. It's not at all clear what this means. In reference to them becoming a band of slaves, it may be due to the fact that Issachar, along with the other nine northern tribes, went into captivity to the Assyrians. But it's not clear that that is so. Actually, Israel endured slavery or bondage to many nations in their history. Issachar, I don't think, is singled out at any time later in history among the nations as being more enslaved than others. It might simply mean that because Issachar, as we know later, received the rich portion of Lower Galilee, they just preferred a life of quiet labor rather than preeminence, and they came under the dominion of other tribes that had more prominence than they. But it's really unclear. It's symbolic language, and it's not entirely clear how it was fulfilled. Verse 16 through 18, Dan shall judge his people. The word Dan means judging. He shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider will fall backward. I have waited for your salvation, O Lord, Jacob says. Now, Dan shall judge his people. We only have one known case in Jewish history where Dan or someone from the tribe of Dan was a judge, and that was Samson. In the book of Judges, there were many judges of Israel. One of them was of the tribe of Dan. That was Samson, and it may be here a reference to the fact that Dan would have at least one member of his tribe who at some point would be significant as a judge in Israel. There are some who believe that the future Antichrist, false Messiah, will be of the tribe of Dan. This idea came from, I don't know if it originally came from the rabbis or from the church fathers, but it comes from very early on, that there will be an Antichrist in the end times whom the Jews will mistake for Messiah, and he will come from the tribe of Dan. Now, it's not clear whether there's any merit for this. I personally have my doubts about this, but I only share it because some people think there's hints of it here. Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper in the path, a sneaky guy, dangerous, bites the horse's heels, and the rider falls backward. This is thought to be perhaps symbolic language for him being treacherous and perhaps of the Antichrist coming from him. Even Jacob saying, I have waited for your salvation, O Lord, the only time he interrupts it to pray, some have thought this is because he's in a vision, he's foreseen the horrible times of the Antichrist. And Dan then would become, or someone from the tribe of Dan in this theory, would judge the nation of Israel, would be God's judgment upon them in the person of the Antichrist. In Revelation chapter 7, verses 5 through 8, we have a listing of the various tribes who comprise the 144,000. And each tribe is mentioned, and it's 12,000 from this tribe, and 12,000 from that tribe, and 12,000 from this tribe. But the tribe of Dan is omitted. Instead, you've got, I think, Manasseh and Joseph mentioned as separate tribes or something like that. And you get 12 tribes listed, but Dan is not among them. He's omitted. And some of the church fathers thought that Dan was omitted from this group of elect Jews because of the fact that the Antichrist would come from the tribe of Dan. But there really is no biblical basis to assume that there will be an Antichrist from the tribe of Dan. There's absolutely nothing beyond what is in this verse and the omission of the tribe of Dan from Revelation 7 and conjecture on the part of rabbis and church fathers. I personally have my doubts about the legitimacy of the theory. There's certainly nothing in the passage that states anything very close to that. If Dan shall judge his people is a reference to Samson, then him being a serpent by the way, biting the heels of the horses, causing the rider to fall backward, overcoming his enemies, in other words, certainly Samson fulfilled that, and there's probably no need to look beyond that for its fulfillment. Verse 19, Gad, which means a troop. He says, Gad, a troop shall tramp upon him, but he shall triumph at last, possibly referring to the fact that Gad was one of the tribes trampled on by the Assyrians when the Assyrians took him into captivity, or possibly during the time of the judges when various nations came and trampled upon the various tribes of Israel, but eventually from time to time they were delivered by judges that were raised up to deliver them. Verse 20 says, bread from Asher shall be rich, and he shall yield royal dainties. Apparently a grain area. Asher's portion of the land apparently produced grain and made it possible to have more pastries and bread and so forth. Verse 21, one of the shortest ones. Naphtali is a deer let loose. He gives goodly words. I have not a clue how that is fulfilled or what it means. You can guess if you want, but if you come up with an answer, know that you're just guessing. No one knows exactly how that's to be understood. Now, the longest of the blessings is given to Joseph, even longer than the one given to Judah. It says, Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall, and that probably is a symbolic way of saying that over the wall, internationally, he had influence. He was fruitful, planted by a well. I don't know what that well is. The well could represent God, God's promises to him that kept him. He's rooted in God's promises, and it survived and bore fruit even when things were going badly in his life. But his reaching over the wall probably has to do with reaching over to not only bless his people, but bless other people of other nationalities, like the Egyptians, whom he blessed by sparing their lives in the famine. It's not clear, though. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. But his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. Now, from there, the shepherd, the stone of Israel is, I suspect the shepherd, the stone of Israel, is Jesus, the Messiah. But it's not saying that the Messiah will come from Joseph. It means that the Messiah will come from the mighty God of Jacob, the last person mentioned, that Jacob's God will eventually send the shepherd, the stone of Israel, the Messiah. Now, notice the symbolism here. He's referring to the fact that his brothers have hated him and tried to hurt him. And he compares it with archers shooting at him, but his bow remained firm in his hand. All of this is totally symbolic, of course. Joseph never had an archery war with his brothers. This is a very excellent way to check out how the biblical prophecies are written in poetry. Because, again, when you get to Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, there's people who want to take everything in there quite literally, even though they're written in poetry. And they miss the point in many cases because they insist on a literal interpretation of Hebrew poetry. This is a good example of how you can't do it, because we know the story. We know the story of Joseph. We know what is being referred to here. We know what literally happened, and we know how it's being expressed here. We can see the extreme symbolism of Hebrew poetry and prophetic statements. And therefore, we need to realize that when we come to prophecy in other parts of the Bible, it's not always going to be understood in a literal sense. There's a lot of imagery there, and it's written in poetry. By the God of your father, who will help you, and by the Almighty, who will bless you, with blessings of heaven above and blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. That just means a lot of children. The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors. Up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills, they shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him who was separate from his brothers. So, he simply pronounces general blessing of a sort that ancient peoples would appreciate on Joseph. And we know that he's already made prior arrangement for Joseph's seed to inherit a double portion of the land. Finally, Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey. At night he shall divide the spoil. Now, I don't believe this for a moment, but I would point out that you could as easily say the Antichrist will come from the tribe of Benjamin from the wording of this as from Dan. The very same kind of fierce, ravenous imagery is used of him as of Dan. There's no better reason to say Antichrist will come from the tribe of Dan than there would be for saying Benjamin. I don't think Antichrist will come from either. But the fact is, it's quite arbitrary, some of the interpretations that have been put on some. I don't know, Benjamin, we do read a fair number of things about the tribe of Benjamin in the future. The first of the judges was Ehud. And he delivered his people by stabbing a fat man to death who had oppressed them. In Judges chapter 3, he was very treacherous. He had a hidden knife under his clothing, and he snuck in and stabbed this guy to death in his bedroom. The men of Gibeah in Judges chapter 19 are also seen to be very fierce. It's a Benjamite city. And they practically fought off all the other 11 tribes of Israel by themselves and almost won, although they ended up losing and become quite a small tribe. They were fierce. The men of Benjamin were often fierce warriors in later battles. In David's day, there were whole battalions, or I guess that wouldn't be the right name for them before they had artillery, but they had whole troops that were made up of Benjamites who were deadly slingers and so forth with slingshots. Two very important people who came from Benjamin were Saul the king and Paul the apostle. Both of whom at one point were quite persecutors of the righteous. Saul persecuted David, and Saul of Tarsus, who became Paul, persecuted the church. So, like ravenous wolves. So, Benjamin, there's a number of ways that we can see the fulfillment of that prophecy about him. Verse 28, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father spoke to them. And he blessed them, and he blessed each one according to his own blessing. Then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron, the Hittite, as a possession for a burial place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is there were purchased from the sons of Heth. And when Jacob had finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, breathed his last, and was gathered to his people. Chapter 50. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. As far as we know, Jacob was the only person buried in Machpelah who was embalmed in the Egyptian way, mummified. So if you would look at Machpelah today in that cave, you might find Jacob fairly well preserved, like one of the mummies of Egypt. The others, Abram and Sarah, those would just all be bones now. By the way, that cave is still known where it is. It's in Israel today. There's a Jewish mosque sitting on it today. And it's a sacred spot to the Muslims as well as to the Jews. But that is really something. That place would be one interesting place to go. Of all the religious sites in the Holy Land that I would be very interested to stand near, is that place where you could look at this mosque and go, under there are the actual bones of Abraham, Sarah, Isaac, Rebekah, Jacob, Leah, maybe Joseph. We don't know. Joseph was carried back in the land. He died in Egypt and was carried back in the land eventually and buried somewhere, probably there. All these people that we read about, their bones are right there now, to this day. That grave has never been violated. So they embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for him, for such are the days required for those who are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, "If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the hearing of Pharaoh, saying, 'My father made me swear, saying, Behold, I am dying. In my grave which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan, there you shall bury me.'" Now, why did it say he dug himself a grave there? He either means in the person of his father Abraham, or more likely, in the cave there were separate burial pigeonholes kind of dug out, and he dug out a space for himself and for Leah and stuff. And so he must have dug in the cave a specific individual burial site, one for himself. "Now, therefore, please let me go up and bury my father, and I will come back." And Pharaoh said, "Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear." So Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the house of Joseph, his brothers and his father's house. Only their little ones, their flocks and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great gathering. Then they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, and they mourned there with a great and very solemn lamentation. He observed 7 days of mourning for his father, and when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning for the Egyptians." Therefore, it is the name which is called Abel Mizraim, which is beyond the Jordan. Abel Mizraim literally means the mourning of the Egyptians. Mourning as in grieving. Mizraim is the name of Egypt in ancient times. So his sons did for him just as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah before Mamre, which Abram bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite as property for a burial place. And after he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt, he and his brothers, and all who went up with him to bury his father. Now, at this point, the brothers were going to find out whether Joseph was really still angry at them and planned to do something to them harmful or not. They had it in their mind that maybe he still nursed a grudge and would have done them harm previously, except that it would have displeased his father for him to do so. So now that the father is dead, there's no restraint upon Joseph from doing whatever harm he may wish to do to them. And it scares them a little bit. And of course, it grieves Joseph that they misunderstand him so much. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "Perhaps Joseph will hate us and may actually repay us for all the evil which we did to him." So they sent messengers to Joseph, saying, "Before your father died, he commanded, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph, I beg you, please forgive the trespass of your brothers and their sin, for they did evil to you. Now please forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of your father. And Joseph wept when they spoke to him, wept because he knew they were lying, knew that they were still afraid of him, and that they had not quite perceived his sincerity up to this point. Then his brothers also went and fell down before his face, and they said, "Behold, we are your servants." Joseph said to them, "Do not be afraid, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, in order to bring it about, as it is this day, to save many people alive. Now therefore, do not be afraid. I will provide for you and for your little ones." And he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So he affirms what he had said actually earlier, that he saw this whole thing as of God. Now, it takes an exceptional kind of faith, more faith than a lot of Christians seem to have, to believe that hardships come on you because it's the will of God for them to. And it's especially hard to believe that if your hardships are brought on by the sins of other people. I mean, if a hurricane blew through and knocked your house down and your children were killed, you might say, well, God's in control of the hurricane. I guess the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I can accept that. But when your troubles come because of people who sin, who are not doing the will of God, in other words, they're disobeying God, and God obviously has no control over them in one sense. He doesn't determine that they will sin. And therefore, it does not seem like he has a direct hand in the trouble that comes to you if you're robbed or raped or beat up or killed or someone else is killed by a drunk driver or something like that. And you say, well, that drunk driver wasn't in the will of God. God didn't want him drunk. Therefore, God wasn't in this. But the Bible teaches that God is in it. Whenever a saint suffers, it is at least by the permission of God. This much we can say. God could have gotten Joseph to Egypt some other way if his brothers had not sinned, if his brothers had not sold him in slavery. God could have found some other ingenious way to get Joseph to Egypt, but this was the best way. It's hard to imagine really any other way that could have done it. When God saw that his brothers were eager to sell him to slavery, God decided to exploit the brothers' plan and go ahead and use it to get his purposes done. Because Joseph had to end up in prison where he would meet the butler. If he had never met the butler, it's hard to know how he would have ever come to Pharaoh's attention and been able to deliver his people as he did. Everything in the story, the most humiliating parts for Joseph, being falsely accused, spending time in prison and so forth, being forgotten by someone who owed him a favor, all of this was part of God's plan. It had to be. And the selling of his brother selling him into slavery, it was the first link in that chain of events, all of which hurt Joseph, all of which were painful experiences, but all of which he saw as being in the chain of events that God intended to happen. And until you can see the hand of God in all of your misfortunes as well, and can bless him in it and say, this he did for our good, you will not be able to cope in a Christian fashion with the sufferings that come into your life. And Joseph obviously didn't need to go to a counselor and get inner healing and get his rejection complex, sorted out or whatever. He saw God in it, and because he saw God in it, he was well adjusted to it. He could receive it from God. Jesus saw it when Judas betrayed him. Now, Judas certainly wasn't doing a good thing, wasn't obeying God when he betrayed Jesus. But Jesus said to Peter, "Don't defend me. The cup my Father has given me, shall I not drink it?" What was being brought upon him by Judas, by the Sanhedrin, by Pilate, by the Roman soldiers, all of those people were sinning, and yet it was the cup his Father had given him. It was the Father who delivered him to these circumstances. We have to realize that even if God is not pleased with the actions of people who sin against us, he could prevent them from doing us any harm if he wished. If he allows it, it is because he has a good plan for us in it, and that there are good things he can accomplish through our sufferings that would be more difficult or maybe even impossible to accomplish without them. So Joseph was had the attitude that every Christian should have. You know, even if someone has maligned you and had no positive intentions for you in it at all, they're totally hostile. Yet they meant it for evil, but God intended it for good. And that's what Joseph observed with reference to his brother's hostility toward him. Verse 22, so Joseph dwelt in Egypt, he and his father's household, and Joseph lived 110 years. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children. Of course, Ephraim was one of Joseph's sons, so he saw his grandchildren and his great-grandchildren and his great-grandchildren. He saw Ephraim's children to the third generation, and the children of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were also brought up on Joseph's knees. So he saw one generation beyond beyond Manasseh. I take that back, two beyond Manasseh, and three beyond Ephraim. So he got to see grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-grandchildren before he died. And Joseph said to his brethren, I'm dying, but God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land of which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. We read, actually, of the Jews in the days of Moses when they made the exodus from Egypt, they made special pains to take the bones of Joseph with them when they left. We read of this in Exodus chapter 13 and verse 19, that when they left Egypt, 400 years after this, approximately, or a little less than that from this time, they did take Joseph's bones, like he said. He didn't want his bones to rot in Egypt any more than his father Jacob did. But because he was an Egyptian official, it would have been less politically correct for him to be buried in Canaan, at least during the lifetime of those Egyptians who knew him and appreciated him. They'd want him to be buried among them in an honorable Egyptian manner, probably in an honorable tomb. But he wanted to end up in Canaan. Perhaps he thought that in the resurrection, it's important for him to be resurrected in the promised land rather than in Egypt. He wanted his body there. It is said that in Hebrews chapter 11 that it was by faith that Joseph prophesied to his brothers of the release of the people from captivity ultimately, and they're going back to the land, and gave instructions concerning the taking of his bones back there. It says that in Hebrews 11, that these instructions were given by Joseph through faith. They're evidence of his faith. We see that, for example, Hebrews 11:22. By faith, Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the departure of the children of Israel and gave instructions concerning his bones. The reason this required faith is that there was no reason for the Jews to be motivated to leave Egypt at that point. They were part of, as it were, a royal family. They had the best of the land to live in. They had abundance. Why should they go back to that desert, which was subject to periodic famines and so forth, of Canaan? What would attract them, especially if they were not very godly people, and many of the Jews were not? Why would they care to leave their comfort zone in Egypt to go back to the land? Well, Joseph knew they would. Joseph knew they would because God had told Abraham, and Joseph was no doubt aware of it, because someone had to preserve this story of Abraham. Joseph must have been among those who had access to it. God had told Abraham that his seed would spend some time in a foreign land and would be brought back. You might remember Genesis 15. And verse 13 and following, then God said to Abraham, know certainly that of your descendants will be strangers in the land that is not theirs, will serve them, they will afflict them for 400 years. Also the nation whom they shall serve I will judge. Afterward they shall come out with great possessions. And verse 16 says, but in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. So God told Abram that his seed would go into a foreign land, they'd be afflicted there for 400 years, but afterwards they'd be brought back to the land of Canaan. Joseph would be aware of that prophecy, and therefore he might have been able to understand that Egypt would in fact be that land where they would come to be afflicted, where God's promise and threat would come true, and then his people would depart from there, delivered by God. However, none of those things appeared to be happening when he died. There was no affliction of his people. There was no motivation for them to want to leave and go back to the promised land. And therefore, it was by faith that he spoke of the time when they would leave and asked that his bones be taken to at the time. And so we end the book of Genesis with Joseph buried in Egypt. But the book of Exodus opens in such a way as to pick up naturally where the Genesis left off. And we find several hundred years pass between the close of Genesis and the opening of Exodus. But at the opening of Exodus, we read of the birth of Moses, and he is the one through whom the deliverance takes place that Joseph predicted. So we'll consider that the end of our treatment of Genesis.